find like a link.
Crazy. Crazy times. Hey, relax. Why are you being so strange? He is just
strange
restless.
Times.
Yeah, true.
So I'm in the how you doing seat.
You are in the hot seat.
In the hot seat.
You're in the hot seat.
Feel like a newscaster.
Oh, you passed me that wine opener before we start. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm going to need to
pen now. Look like we're doing things. Hi. Welcome to
I'm going to do that again.
Hi.
Yay, yeah, that country and western.
Yes. Okay. Shh. Everyone chill. Cool their beans. Okay. He's upset by that.
Okay.
Okay, calm. Hi, welcome to Juice Podcast. I'm Gwen Douglas.
I'm Emily Harmon.
Today's episode, we are doing
Grenache.
So, I think some of you have probably heard of this grape. It's in a lot of stuff.
It is.
Gets around.
It does get around.
Not always the star of the show, but always a good supporting cast, I think.
Yep.
But I think by itself can also be delicious.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, here we've got, Grenache. I think most people are familiar with the word Grenache, the grape variety Grenache. But for those that aren't, it's a grape variety that produces medium to full-bodied wines, so generally high alcohol wines or higher alcohol wines, and an abundance of red fruit, particularly when it's very ripe, it can lend itself to be a little bit of this kind of like raspberry jam kind of character. But when it's made, I think, exceptionally well, and in the best examples, like producers like Chateau Reyes from Châteauneuf-du-Pape that make a Châteauneuf-du-Pape 100% from the Grenache grape, it has these amazing floral characteristics, the aromatics, this almost like chocolate orange note to it as well, that's like quite
speaking
delicious.
Makes a good rosé too, right?
Yes.
So places like Tavel and where else? There's another place I can't remember, also only makes rosé or...
Yeah, I mean, the Tavel rosés are amazing because they're so textured and kind of
rich. And the same with these, like, sort of strawberry floral thing. I think when I was reading, there's a lot of floral notes also in the rosés.
Yeah, I mean, like, Eric Pfiffling. Those wines are amazing. Yes.
I actually think we could probably also do two episodes on Grenache because I think it's, like...
We can do, like, 8 episodes on every topic, probably.
Because I feel like this one gets around so much. Like, I feel like already it's history, because it's what, from one particular... They think it's from one particular part of Spain in Aragon. And that it would have moved towards France. Like, that any movement, no matter where it was from, it would have been moved around because of the King of Aragon. Regardless.
Ah, really?
Yes. So that, that they think it's from Spain, but regardless of where it was from, it definitely moved around because of him.
I mean, and France is definitely... I mean, France now, there's more plantings of Grenache in France than there are in any other country, followed by Spain. Italy, US, and Australia are kind of the key areas for Grenache.
I guess there's also... hang on, let me look at my notes. Did we also have... Yeah, New World also, right? So Australia, you said, California, and then also South America. So I think, like, Chile, Argentina, and Mexico all produce Grenache, which makes sense... Climate-wise, probably.
Yeah, of course, because it's a great variety that needs warm climate to ripen.
Yes.
You know, it wouldn't do so well. And also, Grenache also sometimes doesn't always ripen so easily on the vine or evenly, evenly, not easily. I actually did a harvest at a winery called Commando G in 2018, and they work... other than one white wine that they produce, which really represents a very small amount of the production, I don't think even 5%, they only work with Grenache.
Oh, amazing.
So I had a month of picking Grenache.
I wonder if that's
in Spain.
Do you think also, it's just so planted, because it's planted in the Rhône in France, but also in the sort of
Languedoc-Roussillon,
it's used a lot in... Yeah.
Yeah, and I think also in Provence, Bandol,
Bandol, and yes. So actually, there's just a lot of regions that it grows in. It's not one of those, So when we say get around, it's really around.
It does get around.
Yes. Excited.
Yes. And I think, so we've got two wines from Spain and one from France. We're keeping it local.
Yeah.
Even though Italy, there's quite a bit of Grenache in Italy.
Really?
I also just, it's not, I just don't
just
think
not
of
like
it.
First on your list when you're thinking of grapes to buy.
Yes.
And I mean, we're obviously, because we live in Europe, we're drinking more European stuff. It's harder, and I mean, it's not that easy to get great Australian wines for us here, I think.
Not at all.
No. So as much as we would love to be trying something, maybe, yeah, stick to this area.
Oh, also so South often, I think also you touched on it a bit before, was the case that it's not always a single varietal, it's right. often blended. I mean, we see it, I mean, I can just see on your notes that it says GSM or GMS.
Yeah, but that's...
Which you see in Australia, it's a very yeah. typical blend, which is based on the Rhone blend. Right. So it's Grenache, usually blended with Syrah, often also with Mourvèdre yeah. as well.
And then I guess like the same idea, this Rhone blend is also, you see it in the States, but then they just call it Rhone blend. And apparently they used to grow a lot more Grenache for like high production, like large volume production in California, but that's sort of changed a little bit.
Mm.
Yeah. So here we are with the first one. What are we?
Yeah. I think just touching on that last bit with the Rhone, which because we will get there anyway, but often the Grenache Syrah blend, or sometimes you also sometimes see it blended with a little bit of like Carignan or Sanso.
Yes. Okay.
That grape variety provides a lot of acidity, the Syrah for the spice and the color, and the Grenache for the sort of fruitiness. As well. So that's why
I was going to ask actually. Yeah.
I think it's also, you know, because of it can be quite jammy to then like kind of.
It needs something to
mix
round it out a bit.
Sometimes, yeah.
Whereas on the other hand, Syrah can be also, if it's just by itself,
yeah,
too piney or too whatever, that it's nice to give it a little fruit, soften it out a bit.
So the wine that we're trying now is called Albara. It's 2018 from Envinate. Envinate is a collaborative project between, I believe, four winemakers. They all met when they were studying winemaking.
Oh, that's nice.
And it's spread over different regions. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, so this is from central Spain. They also have a project in Ribeira Sacra.
Okay.
Where they work with Mencia. And then also in the Canary Islands in Tenerife as well. You would know them when we did our first pop-up. We had the white and the red on the list. And, so different winemakers are kind of located in different parts of the world, so there's
but what a fun concept actually.
Yeah, and then they all kind of have an ethos of how they make the wine and the style of the wine. So this is 70% Garnacha Tintorera, so it's the type of Grenache which has the red flesh as well.
Okay. Oh wow, so then it really gives a bigger, deeper,
more color. Yeah. 70% Grenache and also with a little local grape, and then it's whole bunch. And it's vinified and aged in concrete and barrel, but old barrel. 50-50.
It has a really, like, leathery kind of quality.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
And there's a little medicinal thing at the very end. And then also a bit of, like, cassis-y.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a lovely perfume, actually. Because it's got this kind of, like, creamy berry fruit. Like a berry yogurt,
yes,
almost.
But then it still has a... It would be a great unisex perfume. It's got a little bit of this, like, leather.
Biker.
And,
a biker eating a fruit salad. A berry fruit salad.
I was thinking of those, like, Muller Corners. Like.
Yeah, exactly. The cherry one or something. So, quite interestingly, because I actually bought two Spanish Grenaches, because I love Spanish wine, and I love Grenache in Spain, particularly these two. So they're from different regions, but they're from different soils, but they're both made with whole bunch. And I think whole bunch is so important for a grape variety like Grenache, because of the skins being quite thin, because of the tendency to have this sort of very ripe fruit profile sometimes, that when producers are picking a little bit earlier, which is very much the trend now in Spain. That there's
just getting more acidity,
reds. More acidity, and then with the whole bunch as well, you get this spiciness in the wines and this freshness from the skins,
from the seeds. I was going to say, are they using stems too, or is it just like? I think it's
with the stems.
Yeah, then you get that bitterness of the sort of like stemmy.
Yeah, and the stems give a lot of flavor as well.
Obviously, which actually,
at the stems, it also you lose a little bit of color. So if we weren't doing whole bunch, you would expect a darker color than this wine.
It's also interesting because I did have 100% Grenache this weekend, and actually, like by itself, this one was quite smooth and fruity, and whatever they've done has obviously given it some character.
Like shifted the structure slightly. Right, totally. And I think this is really a trend that you're seeing in Spanish wine, particularly over the last 10 years, is that there's been a huge movement towards picking earlier, using whole bunch, doing lighter maceration, so not necessarily pumping down, leaving the wine, so then you get this kind of intercellular fermentation, you get more lifted aromatics because of that, and a different profile of red that actually is very drinkable. I think Spanish wine has, again, it's changed its image drastically over the last decade and is now a super exciting place for red wine.
Yeah, cool.
You know, there was a time where it was very, I don't want to say stagnant, but like it just wasn't dynamic. And like it was always place where you had really oaky, jammy red wines.
I mean, that's kind of when I think about like typical Spanish wines that I might have had in the last whatever, or things that friends drink from the supermarket, you know, the sort of Spanish wines have this sort of idea about them. But this is very interesting because it's not what I expected.
Yeah. I love the spiciness in this wine, actually. And it's high altitude. It's around 800 meters. So because of that, you get a difference in day and night temperatures, which also helps with the freshness, also helps with the complexity, because even if you're picking early, you still have quite a good length of time of the fruit on the vine as well.
I also think this is really versatile for food, because I think you could actually eat tons of stuff with this.
And this is not...
no one can see.
This is not... This is not, this is not an expensive wine either. Oh, I mean, we have it on the list here at Aura, and I think it's either 36 or 38 euros.
Wow, that's really affordable.
For a small producer, it's organically farmed.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I totally think this is like, you can drink it by itself with some snacks, but then it could totally stand up to something grilled. There's enough of that bite at the end that you could charcoal something and it would still be fine.
Yes.
Alongside
it. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Like something grilled would be great.
Yeah, because I think that little bitter end kind of like has enough to, I think it would fruiten up a little bit too with something like this.
Yeah, or even something like a little cassolet or something as well, like a stew.
Like a sausagey. I mean, obviously, because we're thinking Spain, I was thinking also like chorizo.
Yeah, nice. Yes, smoky, meaty.
I think there's enough like of the sort of strong characters that it could hold up to all of that kind of stuff. Nice. I was excited that you were bringing two Spanish, because actually it's not something I drink that often.
Spanish wine in general?
Yeah, I don't think we... Maybe also because Luki doesn't cook so much Spanish, and we're always the sort of in the go together.
Yeah.
I mean, need to get out of that.
I mean, Spain for me has been an area of focus, because I have, for 5 years, I took care of the wine list for Morro and the Two Moritos in London. So they're Spanish, really great Spanish restaurants by Sam and Sam Clark.
So, of course, then your focus is going to
be
on...
Yeah, I mean, the wine list was only Spain, with a little bit of Portugal and a little bit of, like, Moroccan or Lebanese wine.
Oh, interesting.
Or occasionally Greek, because that's the influence of the food.
Right.
Sometimes we squeezed a few Georgians on as well, but we had no French or Italian wine. So for 5 years, I was, you know,
just
every month tasting, you know, maybe 16 Spanish wines a month. So
yeah, I really think it's just not like a region that I've spent too much time. Maybe I should change that. So I think we do get a lot of Spanish wines in this part of the world. Like, they are accessible.
Yes.
Like, they move around enough.
Yeah. I mean, so the next wine that we're having is the one that I actually import.
Look at the colour of this already.
I know.
So
looks like Pinot.
Yeah.
And actually, in some ways, when Grenache is made really well, I do see some commonality between it and Pinot Noir as well, just because it... I mean, especially when it's made like this, I mean, it looks like a Pinot. So it's like this lovely kind of strawberry juice colour.
Yes.
So I've just poured us 2017 Cardamat Valentin Garnacha. And this is... from my favourite region in Spain, which is called Sierra de Gredos. So we're in central Spain, an hour west of Madrid, in these hills or these mountains called the Gredos Mountains or Sierra de Gredos. And it's one of the most spectacular regions to visit, not just visually, but also for the wine, because it's so exciting. Visually, it looks a little bit like Jurassic Park or something from Star Wars. So you have these huge granitic boulders...
Well, amazing.
You know, green covered hillsides.
I can totally see this.
Lots of bird life as well. So when we were picking, I'd be like, the raptors are coming.
Yeah,
you know,
amazing.
Because you just hear it all the time. And actually it's quite rural, so it's visually beautiful. The vineyards are high, over 1,000 meters in some cases. So you have this really interesting climate there. It's one of the later regions in terms of ripening. So I was there from middle of September to middle of October, and we were still picking in the middle of October, because you have these very cool evenings and very hot days.
Interesting.
And Grenache can tolerate the heat. So, yeah. And it's an area where you have a lot of old vineyards. In some cases, a lot of abandoned vineyards. But
oh, really?
There are a number of growers that are working on bringing back these abandoned vineyards.
Oh, that's nice.
And producing wines from them. So it's all bush vines.
Okay.
So that obviously helps with the sun.
With the sun,
well.
Protecting from the elements and whatnot.
Yeah, so old bush vines and granitic soil, so volcanic soil. So you get this even more freshness in the wines.
I know how much you love a volcanic soil.
I do. It's volcanic aromatic.
Yeah.
It's maybe the difference in our personalities.
I was going to say, actually, it's like,
well, it's like this is going down on like more levels than one.
Is this one more... Is there more Grenache in this one?
This is 100%.
100%. Okay. 100%. And I think, like, we can see this maybe already by the colour.
Yeah. And this is...
But you said this one was the Tinto, so that it had the red flesh, which is why we get more of this.
And this is a blend of a few different vineyards, small vineyards put together. And, red granitic sand for these vineyards. Whole bunch, again, 100% whole bunch. And this is a mixture of concrete and barrel.
Does also have a very umami, meaty.
Yeah, for me, it's got this. I know.
And then there's a little
the first thing
else.
I get is strawberry laces. You know, sweets.
See, I get that a little. Yeah, totally. The yum.
And it has got that orange, that kind of like blood orange kind of note to it as well. That's there.
Oh, this is my jam.
I know. Elegant, beautiful Pinot style.
Yeah,
Grenache.
Totally. I think it's
14.5% alcohol.
Wowzer.
This and you don't
fuck
notice
me up.
It.
Because I would, it's so light tasting, it's so delicate that I think like I wouldn't notice.
And I think this is a really good example of how choosing a wine or analysing a wine and focusing on balance rather than just the alcohol percentage on the bottle.
Yeah, right, because actually, you're right, because I think, like, if you were to just look at the bottle and you'd be like, ooh, Spanish, 14% Grenache, you might be like, maybe it's too big for what I'm thinking.
But how racy is the acidity?
But it's so nice, yeah. This is definitely really delicious. And totally right about this Pinot style, that strawberry kind of...
Mm. And I'm, so difference in soils here, semi-similar winemaking to some degree.
Delicious.
This is made by two guys, Kuro and Jesus. They have another project, actually two projects in Galicia, in Ribeira Sacra. Their most well-known project is called Fideos de Couto, which means Brats of the Count. And they're very good friends with Danny Landy and Fernando Garcia, the guys that I work for.
Okay, nice.
Which is how I discovered this wine. Yep. And I think 16 or 17 was the first vintage of this project. So they're only going to get better.
And where can you said you import this one, right?
Yes, and in the UK for the people that are there, Carte Blanche wines import.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah,
this is definitely something I would look for. Mm. I would drink this again.
Yes, and these aren't expensive wines. I mean, on the wine list here, I think it's around 40. So shop price around 20.
I mean, so far it's already
trade price even less. I think it's something like 13 euros or something.
I mean, that's already. Because of course when we get into like the Rhone, I think it gets a little more expensive. Sometimes
I mean, this is at the same price as a Cote de Rhone,
right.
And I think compared to a lot of them, maybe better quality.
Yes. Yeah, because I think always the trouble I have, you know, in the past, because the reason I picked a Chateau Neuf du Pape was A, because I knew you were buying two or bringing two Spanish, and I was like, okay, when we do the classic, because it's kind of, I think, like where everyone first experiences Grenache would be in a Rhone blend. And I know for myself, there was always this idea that like Chateau Neuf du Pape was like Chateau Neuf du Pape.
I know.
You know, when you're young, it's sort of...
It's that special wine. I mean, also because everybody talks about the one with the keys on it. The wonky bottle.
Yeah,
I don't know
it was that
bottle.
One. It was like, I mean, you could get it at Sainsbury's and Tesco's back in the day. But it was always the like, it was like, looks like a bottle that's like 1,000 years old or something. They market it well. But it was always that like, oh yeah. So I think when I started drinking red wines, that's kind of where I went first, was the Rhone, and then really fell in love with Shirazes, and then started drinking more because I was living in North America, so then more Californian or Australian or more New World stuff.
Mm.
So it was interesting to come back as an adult and then revisit these, knowing maybe a little bit more. So I remember you helping me when I was studying for the...
Quartermaster's,
like to try and drink single varietals to understand how they work in a blend. And I remember you brought me a Shiraz, a single varietal from the Rhone that's made by a natural producer sold under a Vin de France, Michel something.
I think it was the Mathieu Barré, no? Was
oh,
it
yeah, it's like a red bottle. just a plain, very simple, I think Michel something, but it was so intensely Shiraz that it was like, or Syrah, that it was
good.
I think it really made me realize that when I drink a Chateau Neuf du Pape or these blends to understand what part plays what. I think is like really nice to then try a Grenache by itself, because I think it's often
And I think particularly in the case of this wine, because we're so used to drinking these like New World like Grenaches
so
that are just
big.
Like fruit bombs, fruit jam bombs, and they're not wines that I like to drink because they're too much.
Yeah, I agreed.
But when you try it like this, it's just like, wow, this is, you know, this is really following this Reyes style of like very pure,
oh, I love
terroir driven, but like elegant and expressive and just, I don't want to say feminine because I'm trying to get, said this before,
refined.
I'm trying to get out of these
refined,
gender
elegant
roles,
yes.
But this prettiness in the wine, I guess.
I mean, I think there can be like, I totally know what you mean about this. Like, it's so hard to like describe feminine and masculine energy without using those terms.
Yes.
Instead of using the line between the two and thinking it more of a bowl of soup.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it is. It's
tough.
Really, yeah, I'm trying to get out of that habit because of so many people say, oh, this is very masculine wine. It's like, well, how, why, what? What even is that?
Right. Because I think we touched on this like the last season that we recorded, because of this idea of like, yeah, elegant. I mean, a man can be elegant and a woman can be elegant.
I mean, I know some very elegant men.
Totally, same. So I think, like, it's important that we also change this language.
Do you like to have a go at Coravining?
Oh, my God. Okay.
Go on.
Do I just
This is the new Coravin model, which I don't actually like because it's really difficult to open
you have
that.
Oh, it's like a hair clip.
Yeah, and that goes on.
And then
you just press down on the top.
Oh, la la.
And then kind of, yeah. There we go. Great. And then you can try with my glass first. Sort of tilt the bottle here and then you have to press this gas.
At the same time.
Oh, yeah, at the same time.
This one.
Yeah.
Boop.
That's it. And then let go.
Oh, wow.
So every time you do that, that injects gas into the bottle to then displace the wine,
gotcha.
To push the wine out. So you'll get, like the more you do it, like that's too much gas. So that's.
I love it because one of my girlfriends, sometimes when we meet for drinks,
there you go.
She will Coravin a bottle of Burgundy, but then by the end of the night, she's like Coravin's like two whole bottles.
Really?
Should have just opened them. When you're like, I've not committed to this hangout yet.
But she would Coravin two whole bottles. Why would she pull the cork?
I know.
She's you start being.
That's what I mean about like not committing, where you're like, no, we're just going to have a glass. And then you're like, okay, well, we finished one. Definitely not going to have a whole second.
Then you have a whole second, and that's when you just pull the cork out. Those bloody capsules are expensive as well.
I know.
They work out about 50 cents a squirt.
Okay, I'm going to be...
Not a squirt, but like per glass. This would be... No, I mean, No, but for us, it's like it's way more worthwhile because like tilt the bottle a bit more.
Yeah.
Higher.
Really?
Yeah.
I actually want
to
buy
it. It just takes a while to get used to it. There you go.
Oh.
Look at that.
Look at that. Sexy.
New skills.
Okay, all right, that's enough. I'm like spit in your face with that thing.
Yeah, it is a bit, isn't it? Sexy.
It's like
kinky.
It's like I'll get you to dismount.
So to dismount. No, I'm just gonna hold it for you.
Do I just like?
No.
Oh God.
That's okay. Just so you pull it up. So we do it in reverse. You pull up from the handle. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then it comes off.
Okay.
Done.
It feels so fragile.
Yeah, but it's okay. The worst that can happen is the needle breaks and I have a spare.
Gotcha.
Wine that Gwen bought is 2017 Chateau Neuf du Pape from La Bastide Saint-Dominique.
Yes. So, I mean, I bought this because I went to Passion Vin to buy some other stuff and figured I would buy a
classic. Coming one of their regular customers, aren't you?
I know. Because I did the same when I was going to Brussels all the time, but now it's like, we've just been happening to do stuff that kind of works out to go there and buying some stuff for myself. So actually, again, I took a recommendation on this one, mostly because I wanted to buy a Chateau Neuf that had a high percentage of Grenache, and this one is 80%.
Mm.
Then it has 10% Syrah, 7% Mourvèdre, and 3% Saint-Saul.
Mm. Yum.
So I haven't smelled this yet.
I mean, visibly very different to the wine before, right? Like it's almost black.
Yeah, it's like much darker even than the first one we had.
Mm. And I think it's so interesting to see such a different style of winemaking here as well. Do you have any, what info have you got for us on this one?
So, we have, other than that, that it's small hillsides, soil, sand and clay. Soil with round pebbles, which I guess is quite normal in that.
Yeah.
In the Rhone, this pebbly...
They're called galets.
Yeah, the sort of...
Yeah, really famous. They actually look like, for people who live in the UK, they look like the stones on Brighton Beach.
Oh, yeah, okay.
A bit. Like that kind of size and that kind of shape.
Okay, so it's really...
Not the black ones, but they're kind of lighter in colour, but yeah.
Small... Yeah, like
they look like a pebbly beach.
So then the vines are like 25 to 80 years old. They do destemming, 18 days of vatting in stainless steel tanks, cap punching, pumping over.
So like it's like the opposite winemaking. So using steel, they're not using any whole bunch, which is why we're getting the darker color, and they're working the grapes more to extract more which
color.
Is why we've got more tannin as well.
Which feels like it's something that happens more on the Rhone.
Yes.
That's sort of what you expect.
Yes.
This like big powerhouse red. I mean, 'cause it has that like big velvety...
Yeah, big time. And that very, very, very intense berry fruit as well. Raspberries, blackberries.
I would say out of the three, this one for me has been the biggest berry flavor.
Yeah, and like full... Like this is 15% as well.
Yeah, this is a...
But it feel you can feel that it's just way more intense, more structured. I mean, you need... You know, you can't... You know, a little oyster or a little green salad's just going to get completely destroyed by this.
I have to say... The taste, I mean, the end is what I expected, but the actual initial flavor is a lot softer and smoother than I maybe would have imagined right off the bat.
I think this wine is so different because you do feel a bit of the heat, but with the right food and the right time of year as well, it would be amazing.
I mean,
a stew.
I was going to say, I love these kind of stuff with these like big, rich French or sort of like Northern Spanish stews.
But even just eating them, imagine on a Sunday afternoon, stuffing yourself with like roast beef and then just laying on the couch.
Also with steak and stuff too. This is also a great barbecue.
Big time.
Barbecue kind of stuff. I wonder why it is that Chateau Neuf du Pape ended up with such a like... Like, what happened in the 70s and 60s? Like, I feel like, was there a moment in history where, like, that was, like, the pinnacle? Was it, because I feel like growing up, there was always this, like, view of Chateau Neuf being a sort of...
I think the UK is a really big market for these wines,
so maybe
right?
That's why, yeah.
And I know what you mean, because I also had the same experience. I think as well, because the bottles,
the labeling,
traditionally they have this... What would you call that? Because it's the opposite of engraved, when it's...
It's not... Yeah, embossed.
Embossed, yeah. So this embossed
instead of
glass
yeah.
with the keys here.
It's so iconic.
It's iconic that people know that, and it makes the bottle look a little bit more special. So for the everyday person, they would see this. And I think it's a little bit like there are certain French appellations.
Sancerre being one of
them. Sancerre, like, even like Fleury from Beaujolais, that like they just show up on like pub lists, on restaurant lists.
So it's like
that the everyday
culture.
Person know that they're kind of like, this is a special wine because it's like one of the more expensive ones. It's like, oh, a Chateau Neuf.
But it's accessible. Maybe there's something about it being like accessible, like high end. So it's like higher end than your average everyday wine that you might drink just for like chats with your girlfriends. But then it's like, it's the nice dinner with your boss wine.
I mean, it's never been as expensive. Like these
That's
wines
I mean,
everyone can access. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
But it's like what you pick for a nice dinner that's a little fancier, a little more expensive than your regular wine, but that feels special. So maybe that's the sort of pop culture, how it fits in.
I think also you're right. And I think. But I do think the additional thing was that this is a style of wine that many
people wanted to
drink at that point. Because also when we're still seeing kind of the results of this, but I think there's a kind of understanding for a lot of people that, or a thought or a theory that the more of the more alcohol, the more intensity, the more body, the more flavor, the more you get.
80s red
represents is like that. The more you have of that, shows that there's more value in the bottle.
I think that's actually very interesting because I do think that like when I think of like 80s big red wines, there is this sort of like Chianti, like all the big like bold, and that kind of energy of like over the topness and indulgence and richness.
I mean, in the UK, look how many people love drinking Malbec.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Malbec from South America. And you're like, because they want something at a certain price. It's just like, I need the power. Bam. This is what I need. This is what I can taste. I need to taste all of it because if it's too
feels
thin,
powerful.
It's too...
Yeah. It feels like you get bang for your buck. It's high alcohol. It's big taste.
Yes.
That's actually very interesting.
Big taste like... equals big money and equals, okay, I've got my value for money here.
So interesting, actually, because then you think, like, how the sort of pop culture of just wealth perception distribution around, and perception of wealth changes how we perceive products that we taste. That, like, during, you know, maybe now things are changing. You know, we've talked in other episodes about the sort of people wanting quirky things now. So that's sort of maybe how our time will be recognized. It's like, oh, remember back in the early 2020s that people were like, everyone actively looking for different. So it's like, maybe, yeah, maybe when we're looking for different, it's sometimes interesting to go back to what we haven't examined in a while.
I agree. And I mean, it's definitely like a journey that I notice I've been on with my wine taste, because I would say I've always been drawn to the more eclectic, esoteric, you know, off the beaten path. But I have noticed that the last few years, my tastes have gone full back loop to
into classics.
Because I'm like, oh, I haven't had that for a while. I want to go back.
And there's
a different
appreciation, I think, when you go back now with the journey you've been on, to be like, you know, there's something about this that's, it's classic, but just like a little black dress or whatever, the classic is sometimes not a bad thing.
Yeah.
It has a moment.
Yes.
A place, a time and a place.
And funny enough, Chateauneuf du Pape was the first wine region I ever visited.
Really?
Yes. I went I went for my ex-boyfriend's father's birthday. And so we ended up going there. We stayed down in Avignon and we just did one day trip to Chateauneuf du Pape. And I just remember it being unbearably hot. Like being like going from an English summer to like 40 degrees.
When you think like an English summer... Like growing up, if it was like 23, you're like, oh my God, it's so fucking hot today.
Old people start dying.
Yeah, you're like, it's 23. Whereas anywhere else in the world, you're like, oh, it's a little bit chilly, you need a cardigan.
I know. And so then we went there, and I remember there was like a big wine fair on that happens every year in Chateauneuf called the Fête de Vérézion. And it's a like a little festival, and there's lots of, all the producers bring their bottles and set up a table. And it's done around the time of when the grapes colour. So it's like about a month or a few weeks before when they pick the grapes.
I mean, that's a smart time to have a party. When you're like, you're not pressured yet about having to pick anything. You're like, this is the waiting moment where we're just sort of celebrating
And let's sell as much wine as we can because we need to make space in the cellar.
I mean, all of it is very clever. I love it.
So we were there wading through 15% wine after 15%
fuck,
wine.
Holy fuck, actually.
Like, it was like 37 degrees and I was just like, oh my God.
It's also funny because it's like the last thing I want to drink when it's... 7 degrees would be this, to be
and
honest.
I never, this is what I never understand. Also, like in Tuscany, regions like that, obviously, red grapes are like abundant and there's more of them grown. But I'm like, why are people not making bloody rosé in these places? Because it's so hot.
You drink it cold.
Yes.
I guess, like, because I actually love this kind of stuff at night, you know? Mm. That, like, when the night cools from a hot day, there's something about these kind of wines that feel really nice. Like the feeling of hot pavement after the sun's gone away.
Yes.
That kind of lingering heat. I think there's something about those wines that gives you that feeling of lingering heat.
Yeah.
But certainly not what I'm smashing at 37 degrees in the sun.
No, it was like just sort of going around in delirium. You're like, I can't.
I'm so parched.
Also, from the tannins as well. So you're like, my lips are red.
Yeah.
I literally have, like, my mouth is like a desert right now. And I think I'm going to pass out. And am I drunk? I don't know, because it's not
You're
fun.
Just like in between. I'm floating between two worlds right now.
I thought being drunk was fun.
Not today.
Yeah, not today.
I'm actually, like, curious about the lip thing, because I always wonder, like, I wonder if there's a particular, like, scientific reason why some people get, like, black lip and black tongue and other people don't.
I think it's how hydrated your lips are.
Because I generally don't, but I know Lukey sometimes the next day will wake up and he's, like, still black.
Does he not give them a wipe before he has
to like, if we brush, you know, I mean, I'm talking about when we're, like, tied one on.
Okay, what? Sorry, what does that
you're
mean?
Just, like,
tied
wasted.
One on?
Like,
okay, I'm just checking.
Like,
that sounded
drunk,
a bit
pass up. No, it's not that kind of tying up.
When you tied one on, I was just like, okay.
No, I mean,
a lot,
like,
of details to share.
Or, like, you just know, like, when you're out with people, like, towards the end of the night, like, there's always...
I'm prone to a black lip sometimes. I've noticed that at tastings, teeth and my lips. I mean, the teeth is also because the enamel's just wearing away from wine tasting over the years anyway.
I mean,
so
also,
often in there like this. Like,
yeah, but also with enamel, like, each of us has different, like, I've never, you know, some people have this blue-white enamel and others have, it's not the one I have the very European, not so white. And then I drank shitloads of coffee for most of my life and, Yeah.
Yeah, and it also depends of, like, if you haven't had them professionally cleaned, if you've got some tartar on there, then it, like, anything will stick to that.
I wonder about people's pHs also, if this is something that, like, I'm curious. So if anyone knows why, I want to know. I'm curious about that.
I notice if, like, if I'm dehydrated and my lips are drier or stressed, then I notice that, like, immediately they're red. So, I mean, I'm often, if I'm at a wine tasting or an event, I mean, I'm regularly going to the bathroom just, getting a piece of tissue, spitting on it and just, like, rubbing the hell out of my lips so I don't look like a crazy person.
There was a thing when I was bartending, Pepto-Bismol, which I guess is much more popular in North America than it is.
It's like Gaviscon, isn't it?
Yeah, it, like, just helps with acid reflux. So a lot of bartenders love a bit of Pepto because we have hard nights. But there was always this sort of, there's something really funny. If you drink Pepto-Bismol and then drink alcohol, it turns your tongue black. There's, like, a chemical reaction that happens. So you could always tell, like, we had, you know, this was a big nightclub. So you could see, like, the regulars that were coming, like, every night and, like, really going hard. You see them the next day and you're like, pop their mouth. Like, the whole inside is black. You're like, someone had a little Pepto dinner before coming over.
A Pepto-Vino night.
Yeah, like, had a little Pepto and then came back to the bar, drink a couple of drinks, and then your whole mouth goes black. So note to self, don't do that.
I was once a tongue model and I had my tongue painted black.
You're a tongue model.
My lips, yeah. Because I've got a very long tongue.
So do I. I can actually stick my tongue in my nose.
Okay. I can't stick mine in my nose. Oh my God. Oh my God.
I mean, I have a low-hanging nose. It makes it easy. That's what happens. It's the pros to a witchy snoot.
Yeah. I'll show you the picture at the end.
It just makes me think of, like, the time where, like,
I got a magazine on a gothic thing. So my whole face was, this half of my face was painted white because you only see this just part of it. And then you see my tongue kind of
hilarious.
Yeah, black. And I have black lips painted on as well.
So funny.
Yeah, it looks kind of creepy.
I love those kind of pictures. We found a really weird one of me while I was unpacking, of me holding, like, a whole pig's head. Very strange. That was for an expo years ago.
So maybe we should post that on our stories.
I don't know. It's like at the point now where I have like too many vegan friends and clients.
I was about to say, I don't know what the...
Yeah, I mean, I haven't put it up. It's like been sitting in a folder for the last 15 years. But a really like amazing friend and fantastic photographer, Rémi Thierrot, took it. And someone bought the print that he was like massive. Like, I would love to see where it's sitting because it's like... The original is like a massive print in a huge black lacquer frame.
Mm-hmm.
It's a statement. So I'd love to see yours. Maybe we do a side by side. Pig's heads and black tongues.
Yeah, you're on. Yeah. No problem.
So I don't know. Is there anything else we want to talk about Grenache especially? I mean, I think it's like we've only scratched the surface here in just these sort of like that it can be in blends, that it's quite delicious by itself. It makes a fabulous rosé. It travels around.
Yeah. And I think, be open to the fact that it may present itself in different ways. And if you're not necessarily into the very intense style, then I would say, you know, look for regions like Gredos and look for whole bunch Grenache. And equally, on the flip side, if you've tried the whole bunch, you don't like it, and you want something more concentrated, appellations like Châteauneuf-du-Pape, Côte du Rhône, some of the other Southern Rhône appellations would definitely be the way to go. And the Roussillon, which we don't have one today, but there's a lot of good value, just like single varietal Grenache being grown in the Roussillon.
I think we'll do probably like a
Roussillon.
Yeah, or like that sort of the lower part regions, because I think there's a lot of underrepresented wines in that region too that are some really special gems. Mm.
Yes.
So I guess by the time this episode airs, it's warm weather and we've been out on the balcony.
Yeah, so just do what I did and go into the heat and drink loads of Grenache.
Get fucked up and then take a nap and do it all again tomorrow.
Yeah.
So with that said, you can find us on Twitter at @juice_podcast.
@juice.podcast on Instagram.
And you can find us on our personal pages. I'm obviously Gwen Douglas with the U.
And I'm Vina Lupa.
And that's it. Until next time.
Cheers. Boom.